Bean Dad, The Dress, 30 to 50 Feral Hogs. If you knew what any of those were, you spend too much time online. And hey, I do too. 16th Minute of Fame is a new weekly podcast hosted by me, Jamie Loftus. And every week, we take a closer look at an internet character of the day. Who are they? What made them so notorious? How did the internet or the algorithm choose them? And what does a person do when they're suddenly confronted with more attention than the human psyche can handle? Listen to 16th Minute of Fame on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What? I don't have an intro, my audience, because we are like 2 hours and change into talking about George Lincoln Rockwell, and I'm just broken as
a man. You're a little beat.
There's only I have to fix myself somehow. I have to get myself back in the fight.
I think this cathartic release of pent up information and frustration will be good.
You know what else might be good? You know what might get me back on track so we can do this last part? Mm-hmm. Oh, and I picked a particularly savory looking burrito. Oh, yeah.
My mouth just started
look
to salivate.
One. Look at how much.
That's got flavor on it,
that is
man.
Dusted
that
with
that
flavor.
Is gonna cut your tongue up.
All right.
Mm. Beautiful.
I can taste that.
Mm.
Now I'm jealous.
Mm. You can have a Dorito. Mm-hmm. As many as you want.
One bite, one cream.
There are so many Doritos. You have to listen to the last one to know. Let's see, okay.
But you shouldn't be listening to three without two.
All right, don't listen to part three if you're...
Oh, Katie, that was a perfect crunch. I do apologize to Molly and my other listeners who hate the sound of crunching Doritos.
Is there a specific person who's like, I don't like when you crunch
She's
Doritos?
She's great. Yeah. But yeah, she doesn't like the sound of crunching Doritos.
Sorry, Molly.
All right. We're done with the crunching of Doritos. If you
one
took
crunch,
your,
one cream.
One
there
crunch, one
Sorry,
cream.
Yeah, yep. Rhymes better.
I do keep singing it in my head to different tunes, but I'm not going to do that to you guys. Mm-hmm. One crunch, one cream. Ew, cut that.
I crunch and cream in the night so I can.
I'm so sorry. I brought this on everybody.
I'm tremendously sorry. This is terrible. It's still this cream, which needs to be refrigerated, is still on the table. It's
Does
still
it
there.
It was
behind the sink like it was soap. So I brought it in.
I do wash my hands with hazelnut cream.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
All right. Well, it's today's episode of Behind the Bad Truth, which I did not even introduce.
Whoops.
But
that is what we're doing right now.
You know where you are.
This is a podcast where we talk about terrible people, and we're talking about one of the worst that there's ever been.
Real bad.
The fucking J.R.R. Tolkien of racism.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The, what's another foundational? The Bill Gates of also racism. The Steve Jobs, of American fascism.
Sorry, you mean Steve Apple?
Steve Apple. George Lincoln Rockwell. Now, in episode 1 and 2, we talked about Rockwell's life, his stunning variety of innovations, which we're not at the bottom of yet.
I want to be at the bottom of it, though.
You really want to be at the bottom. And, of course, we talked about his death, where he was murdered by one of his followers who went on to become not a Nazi. That
and his classically handsome bone structure.
And his classically handsome bone structure. Yeah, great. We don't hate his bone structure.
No.
Taller than Hitler, too.
Which is important. For America, it would be amazing if that's the one. If you transplanted Hitler in America, the only reason he wouldn't take off is he's too short.
Too short.
I mean, it's a thing.
The Germans are just not shallow enough to. No, we can embrace a short fascist.
I love this. It's like embracing that slogan. Mm-hmm. Vote for me, taller than Hitler.
Today we're talking about Rockwell's legacy. In addition to obviously the legacy of trolling college campuses for donations, Holocaust denial, neo-Nazism, we're talking about a much more complex and bloody legacy. All of that. A legacy that ties in literally every act of far-right violent terror you have heard about in your entire lives. They all descend from GLR. In the early 1980s, a far-right radical named Robert J. Matthews created what he called an action group. Its original name was The Organization, but eventually he settled on calling it The Order. He recruited a small squad of others. Oh, just wait. It's even losery than you understand right now. He recruited a small squad of other like-minded men. The Order was a fascist, white supremacist terror group. Its goal was to destabilize the fabric of American society through violent attacks. The Order funded its operations by robbing banks and armored cars. They carried out three murders, including the highly publicized assassination of Jewish-American radio host Alan Berg in 1984. The Order was eventually infiltrated and wiped out by the FBI. Matthews died fighting after a 36-hour-long standoff. While they did not succeed at destroying the fabric of American society, the Order did steal millions of dollars, at least a million of which was never recovered by the authorities, and probably went on to finance further fascist terror. 13 white supremacist leaders were prosecuted for taking Matthews' money, so it's anyone's guess as to how many other violent racists he funded. They committed like 20-something robberies that were successful. Robert J. Matthews never met George Lincoln Rockwell, but the commander had a strong impact on his life nonetheless. This was thanks to a book, The Turner Diaries, written by William Luther Pierce. Pierce had started life, in 1933, as a quiet kind of geeky kid. He later described himself as sort of a nerdy kid without social skills. He was awkward around girls and obsessed with science fiction. When he grew up, he became a pretty good physicist.
All right.
Pierce became aware of Rockwell in 1963 when he saw the commander on TV addressing a crowd of protesters. According to one of Pierce's co-workers, who was interviewed later by the FBI, quote, he was looking for a simple solution to the problems of the world. Nazism provides that.
Simple solutions to complex problems.
Just blame it all on the people with three little things around their names. There is a report, The Turner Legacy, published by the International Center for Counterterrorism. Here's how it summarizes the path of Pierce's radicalization. Quote, "You can do nothing until you've reached the masses," Rockwell explained in an interview. "In order to reach them without money, without status, without a public platform, you have to become a dramatic figure." Intrigued, Pierce wrote a letter to Rockwell, and they struck up a correspondence. In 1965, Pierce moved from academia to work with a defense contractor in Connecticut, and he began driving on weekends to the Washington, D.C. area, where Rockwell was based. He also spent time at the Yale University Library, reading alarmist books about racial trends, many dating back to the 1920s and 30s. As his relationship with Rockwell was blooming, Pierce was granted a secret government clearance through his job, although he never worked on a classified project. He rarely displayed his racism to coworkers. When the FBI opened an investigation of Rockwell's American Nazi Party, agents spoke to his former colleagues. Many found him distant and impenetrable and expressed their intense dislike of him as a person. Nevertheless, they conceded, he was a first-class physicist.
It's just science.
In 1966, Pierce was responsible for launching National Socialist World, a quarterly journal of all things Nazi. The NSW eventually attracted more than 1,000 subscribers. It was one of Rockwell's AMP's few profitable endeavors. After Rockwell's assassination, Pierce went on to found a group called the National Alliance, but his true love was writing unspeakably racist fiction. In 1978, he published his opus, The Turner Diaries. Pierce imagined a near-future world in 1991 when a new American government called the System enforced racial integration. Since Pierce was a Nazi, he imagined the system as run by Jewish people with black people as their enforcers. The system, in the Turner Diaries, is portrayed as the ultimate far-right fantasy of a far-left government. Tax breaks for mixed-race couples, the repeal of rape laws because they're seen as affronts to race and gender equality, and, of course, gun confiscation. Mm. The book is written as a series of diary entries from a man, Earl Turner, who joins a terrorist group called the Order and takes part in a violent revolution to conquer the United States for white people. The Order funded itself through bank and armored car robberies. They assassinated left-wing and Jewish politicians and media personalities and bombed government buildings. This eventually sparked a gigantic race war, leading to a global genocide of all non-white peoples and the establishment of a Caucasoid utopia.
This was the happy ending of the book?
Yeah, that's the happy ending of the book. It's not explicitly Nazi through most of it, but at the end they refer to something happening as being 130 years after the birth of the Great One, which is, of course, Adolf Hitler.
Yeah, he's a nerd. Like,
self-admitted, a sci-fi nerd who was bad with women, who went on to write racist science fiction.
Yeah,
fantasy.
You have to be a Nazi nerd.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, weird how that keeps happening.
Mm-hmm.
Despite its terrible plot,
just a nice guy.
Girls don't like me. Physics. Nothing's wrong with physics. Despite its terrible plot, absurd racism, and clunky style, the Turner Diaries include some pretty apt observances about the nature of terrorism. In one passage, Turner notes that the system furthers its own destruction by reacting to the Order's terrorism by instituting emergency powers and clamping down on individual liberties. Turner also discusses the idea of propaganda of the deed, which started with anarchists in, like, the 1800s and is why President McKinley did not finish his term. The organization prioritizes attacks that do economic damage, like bank robbery, because those things make middle-class white people the most frightened and uncomfortable. Quote, "What is really precious to the average American is not his freedom or his honor or the future of his race, but his paycheck. He complained when the system began busing his kids to black schools 20 years ago, but he was allowed to keep his station wagon and his fiberglass speedboat, so he didn't fight." Not surprisingly, The Turner Diaries was Robert Matthews' favorite book. It directly inspired the creation of his own The Order.
Mm-hmm.
The Turner Diaries was required reading among the terrorists Matthew recruited. According to the Turner legacy, quote, "When he recruited a former Klansman, Thomas Martinez, into the group, he did so by handing over a copy of Turner, one of the scores that he kept in storage. Members of the group referred to the book as their Bible. Tom, in there is what the future will be, Matthews told Martinez. You must read it. You must."
Mm.
Bet it doesn't go much further than that.
We're done, right?
We're done. That's it.
Thanks
That's
for
the episode. Do you guys
want to
throw in your Twitters?
Pluggables?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Let's read the next paragraph, see if there's anything else. During his time in the ANP, Pierce had come to believe that the showy displays of white nationalism, the swastikas and Klan robes then in vogue, alienated what he called normal people. Near the end of his life, Rockwell had been making the exact same moves, engaging in a process of denazification to try and appeal to more mainstream white people.
The normies, they might call them.
The normies.
They might call them normies.
They might call them. Trying to red pill them about white power. Obviously, the Turner Diaries did not have that much more mainstream appeal than Rockwell's ANP. But it did succeed in appealing to a broader base of radicals than, say, Stormtrooper magazine. One of those radicals was a young man named Timothy McVeigh. The Turner Diaries was Timothy McVeigh's very favorite book. Now, McVeigh was not an ideological racist, first and foremost. He definitely ran with and was associated with some racist groups, but he was more of an anti-government pro-gun nut than, like, a specific Nazi nut or anything like that. And he was, of course, a lone wolf. But he did hate the government. He viewed it as a nightmarish monster bent on stamping out all human liberty, and he saw the Turner Diaries as an entertaining blueprint for how that monster might be killed. The structure of McVeigh's attack on the Murrah Building in Oklahoma City was directly inspired by a passage from the Turner Diaries. At one point, Earl Sell bombs the FBI headquarters, which is, of course, the first place that Tim McVeigh thought about bombing before he decided the Murrah Building would be easier. Pierce goes on into exhaustive detail about the bomb that they used to blow up the FBI building, a truck bomb made with 4,400 pounds of ammonium nitrate, essentially the same device McVeigh constructed and used to destroy the Murrah building.
Cool.
On the day McVeigh detonated his bomb, killing 168 people, he put together a manifesto in an envelope in his car and included many photocopied pages of the Turner Diaries. McVeigh had highlighted one passage in particular from a chunk of the book where Earl Turner's cell carries out a mortar attack on Washington, D.C. Quote, The real value of our attacks today lies in the psychological impact, not in the immediate casualties. More important, though, is what we taught the politicians and the bureaucrats. They learned this afternoon that not one of them is beyond our reach. They can huddle behind barbed wire and tanks in the city, and they can hide behind the concrete walls of their country estates, but we can still find them and kill them. That's what McVeigh highlighted after blowing up the Oklahoma City bombing, which included a daycare full of babies. Weird way to read that line. But
you know, we all have our interpretation of the words we read. Mm-hmm. We all have different reactions to art. Mm-hmm.
That's a gracious interpretation
of the Turner Diaries.
trying real hard to...
In 1994, a year before McVeigh's attack, the Aryan Republican Army carried out a series of bank robberies, inspired by both Matthew's Real the Order and the order from Pierce's book. Some of those people were later linked to the Oklahoma City bombing. The ARA put out a two-hour video statement at one point that urged people to read the Turner Diaries. They also stand hard for Christian identity, which is an incredibly important ideological movement that's also tied into all of this, and that we'll get into more in the audiobook that I'm putting together. We'll talk about that some and get the end to. The Aryan Republican Army carried out 22 robberies in 7 states before the FBI took them down. They were succeeded by another terrorist group, the Aryan People's Republic, who carried out a murder, bombing, and robbery campaign in 1997 that killed 5 and ended in a massive police shootout. Both groups were, of course, directly inspired by the Turner Diaries. On April 12, 1997, Larry Wayne Schumach of Jackson, Mississippi, shot 11 black people, killing 1. When interviewed later, his friends and family all said he'd undergone a sudden shift towards violent radicalism after reading the Turner Diaries.
Oh. I'm sensing a through line here.
Might be one there. You might be reading into things a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Don't. You sound like a conspiracy theorist.
I'm just acknowledging a pattern, you know?
In 1998, 3 white dudes in Jasper, Texas, chained a black man to the back of their pickup truck and dragged him down the road, horrifically torturing and killing him. One of the men gave this statement to the police. We're starting the Turner Diaries early. That is technically incorrect because the Turner Diaries was set in 1991 and 1998. But, you know, racist and math.
I feel like he should have said, that's going to change his mind.
Say, we're finally starting
we're
the
finally,
Turner Diaries.
That would have been the right way for this murderous...
Actually, technically.
That would have been one of the cops who read the Turner Diaries.
Right.
In 1999... David Copeland, a British man, set off several shrapnel bombs in London. His targets were black and gay people. He killed 3 and injured 140. In his confession to the police, Copeland said, "If you've read the Turner Diaries, you know in the year 2000 there will be the uprising and all that racial violence on the streets. My aim was political. It was to cause a racial war in this country."
Year 2000?
The list goes on and on and on and on. There have been fatal attacks in Germany, Ukraine, and many, many more attacks in the United States by people who claim the Turner Diaries is their direct inspiration. As of 2016, the book has been tied to more than 200 murders and dozens upon dozens of separate attacks and foiled attacks. Christopher Hassan, the Coast Guard lieutenant who was caught in 2019 before he would carry out his planned massacre, was a huge fan of the Turner Diaries.
Huh.
William Pierce died in 2002 of being an old-ass piece of shit. Before he died, though, he gave interviews to a biographer. In those, he was questioned about some of the attacks his book had inspired. When he was asked about Robert Matthews, founder of the Order, he said this. "Bob was a very intense young man and quite different from the weaklings I see so many of in America today. Bob was obviously very much taken with the Turner Diaries, and it was clear he drew a lot of the elements from the book and the way he did things and the terminology he used, and so on."
And so forth.
That's not it.
Okay.
The Turner legacy went on to note, quote, "Pierce eulogized Matthews repeatedly in interviews and on shortwave broadcasts of his National Alliance's radio program. With McVeigh, the calculus was more complicated, the backlash more severe. Pierce took pains to say that he had never met McVeigh, and there is no direct evidence to say otherwise, although McVeigh's telephone records presented in court showed that he made efforts to contact the National Alliance prior to the bombing. Pierce was defensive about whether and how specifically McVeigh's actions could said to be have been inspired by the book, despite a mountain of evidence pointing towards its relevance. Waco was the inspiration for Oklahoma City, Pierce argued, not his book."
What?
They both were.
Read your book, man.
He used the same bomb that you described in loving detail.
You did just say he had the highlighted pages,
yep,
right?
In his manifesto after the bombing.
I don't know. That seems like a pretty... Clear link.
Seems like McVeigh said they were tied.
Oh, well, maybe the blatant racist isn't great on understanding evidence
to
begin with.
That seems weird.
Mm. Mm.
We could talk about William Pierce and the Turner Diaries all day. You'll get more on that in the audiobook thing that I'm shamelessly plugging still. Shamelessly. But this episode is, above all else, about George Lincoln Rockwell's intellectual legacy, and that legacy is a lot bigger than the trail of blood Bill Pierce left behind. James Nolan Mason was born in 1952. He grew up in Chillicothe, Ohio, and like William Pierce, he saw lurid news coverage of Rockwell's rallies and speeches. Mason became enthralled with the American Führer. At age 14, he started sending him letters. Rockwell wrote back, and Mason became a member of the ANP Youth Organization. When he turned 18, he was inducted as a full stormtrooper. After Rockwell died, Mason moved on to the National Socialist Liberation Front, and eventually formed a group called the Universal Order. In the 1980s, he started writing a series of papers for a neo-Nazi newsletter, Siege. In those articles, he advocated for what he called leaderless resistance, autonomous terrorist action by individuals and small groups rather than coordinated large-scale movements, because the FBI kept infiltrating those.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, on the subject of FBI infiltrating people, you guys remember Trooper Oak?
Yeah. Previously Pine?
Burchard or something like that. Yeah. He was actually like a college student researching violent extremism who went undercover in the group to like write about them and stuff.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they got infiltrated a number of times.
Oh, yeah.
It's good stuff.
My man Oak.
My man Oak.
All right.
Because Birch is too sissy.
Yeah, it's too close to...
He was like,
Birch,
yeah,
the coward's tree.
It's all making sense.
Weak ass tree. Nah, you're an oak. And a cop, apparently.
Countering violent extremism researcher.
Yeah.
Good guy. Sure. Thanks, Trooper Oak.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Burchard.
Ads.
Not the tool in ads.
Yeah,
no. But you might be able to buy one.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know what these ads are for.
Maybe they're ads for ads.
Maybe they're ads for ads. Let's hear them. The evidence keeps pouring in. At this point, the facts are undeniable. It's an open and shut case. Monopoly Go is the most fun you can have in a mobile game. Millions of people pass Go every day because this game is always bringing something new to the table. Countless crazy tournaments you can join with your friends as partners or teams. Constantly changing challenges like money sprees or treasure hunts that keep it fresh with new wild minigames. Timed events offering bonuses like massive multipliers or rent frenzies to help you get huge rewards. And there's so many rewards to discover. Rare stickers you can trade with friends to complete albums, delightful emojis to taunt people with when you raid their riches, unique playing pieces, and so much more. The verdict is in with Monopoly Go. There's something new to discover every time you play. So don't miss out. Go download it now for free on the App Store and Google Play.
Bean Dad, The Dress. 30 to 50 feral hogs. If you knew what any of those were, you spend too much time online. And hey, I do too. 16th Minute of Fame is a new weekly podcast hosted by me, Jamie Loftus, where every week I take a closer look at an internet character of the day. Who were they? What made them so notorious? Why did the internet choose them? And what does a person do when they're suddenly confronted with more attention than the human psyche can handle? I'll be talking to internet historians, experts, and yes, the main characters themselves to get a fuller picture. Because I think that even outside individual experiences, a character of the day tells us something about how the internet worked at that time and how the attention economy developed into the freaky three-headed dragon it is today. Together, we probably won't be able to properly log out, but we can take a walk down scary internet memory lane and see one day a little more clearly. Listen to 16th Minute of Fame on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh, my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season 2 of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back.
Yeah.
We were having a fun little break chat about all the kids in cages.
Not cages.
You're right.
Areas
that are caged.
Yes.
For safety.
For safety.
Safety boxes.
Safety boxes.
I wouldn't use the word cage. I would use the cage. I would.
Safety kid boxes. A pen for kids. A crib. Cute little metal crib.
A cute little metal crib. Mm-hmm.
We put them kids in nurseries mm-hmm. with bars.
Mm-hmm. With bars. Barred nurseries. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. Let's get back to talking about James Nolan Mason.
Good.
So, Mason started writing for, after Rockwell died and he left, started writing for a neo-Nazi newsletter called Siege, and, you know, advocated for leaderless resistance and stuff like that. Many of his writings were collected into a book also called Siege. Here is a quote from that book. "The lone wolf cannot be detected, cannot be prevented, and seldom can be traced. If I were asked by anyone of my opinion on what to look for or hope for next, I would tell them a wave of killings or assassinations of system bureaucrats by roving gunmen who have their strategy well mapped out in advance and well nigh impossible to stop." I should note here that Chris Hassan's planned shooting spree of, you could call them bureaucrats, elected political officials and journalists and the like, people know it was stopped. Right. I think a lot of people think it was stopped because the FBI was out looking for white nationalist, you know, terrorists.
Infiltrating these organizations, as mm-hmm. they've said they have been.
No. He was caught because he was buying Tramadol on his work computer. He was illegally buying painkillers, and that's the only reason he got caught.
That's far less sexy.
They found out about the massacre by accident.
Wow, I didn't
know. Yeah, that was an accident.
Oh,
that was totally just a happy accident. They were just busting him for drugs.
Oh, that's such a bummer. Oh, my God.
It's totally a bummer. I feel safe.
I feel safe.
It's a real problem.
There were a lot of DSA people on his kill list. Some people are saying, if you are in the DSA, maybe arm yourself. I'm not saying arm yourself. I'm saying the police aren't really good at catching the Nazis who want to kill you.
The Nazis in their own organizations mm-hmm. who like actively have said in many, many years mm-hmm. that they're going to try to infiltrate law enforcement organizations in the military
yeah.
for these purposes.
I'll say self-defense is important for anyone, especially the politically active, and there's mm-hmm. a variety of pathways to self-defense. So mm-hmm. consider how you plan to defend yourself.
Consider.
Maybe with just love.
Maybe with love. Sometimes that works.
Mm-hmm. With my feet and my fists.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Whoa.
Mm-hmm. And maybe body armor. Never bad thing
maybe
to have around.
Maybe just protection.
A little bit of body armor here and there.
Learn a little mutual aid in case something happens.
Mutual aid.
Maybe to sort mm-hmm. of, yeah.
Magic.
Magic would help.
Oh, Harry Potter would be really useful right about now.
Like a grand wizard.
No.
Too far. Not use the words right?
Yeah, you used them. Maybe a warlock of some sort.
Maybe a warlock.
Like a great warlock.
A great warlock. A solid warlock.
Yeah, not a grand wizard. For whatever reason, that was a poor choice of words.
Still not clear why, but...
Not clear why. Don't know why, but I'll adjust.
Back on the subject of Siege. On March 1st, 2018... Adam Waffen burst onto the American consciousness with the murder of Blaze Bernstein, a student at the University of Pennsylvania. Bernstein's murder was tied to a member of the group Adam Waffen, because Blaze was homosexual and Jewish, and basically the distillation of everything Nazis hate. British journalist Jake Hanrahan did a lot of that reporting, by the way. He's got a podcast, Popular Front, that's really worth checking out. He's a great guy. Anyway, Adam Waffen is a multinational terrorist group that sprang up like mushrooms on the damp bathroom floor of the internet. There are somewhere around 20 cells, perhaps more, perhaps less, mostly small groups all around the United States and in Germany. Five deaths have so far been tied to Adam Waffen. One other thing Adam Waffen did was republish James Mason's Siege, a book they basically consider their Bible. Mm-hmm. Now, Siege has not yet inspired as much direct violence as the Turner Diaries. That would be hard to do. It was sort of rediscovered pretty recently, starting on the old neo-Nazi forum Iron March. Over the last several years, a whole online subculture has spread out around the book. If you spend a lot of time reading messages from members of the Bowl Patrol, for example, they bring up Siege all the time. You guys know about the Bowl Patrol?
I don't,
no.
Actually.
No.
You guys know about Dylan Roof?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, the guy who in 2015 walked into a black church in Charleston and murdered 9 people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He had a bowl haircut. And oh. So there's people online who call him Saint Roof,
oh.
And they call themselves the Bowl Patrol because they, too, would really like to... murder a bunch of black people in a
losers,
church.
My God.
And they love Siege. Big fans of Siege.
Quick question. Mm-hmm. Who's publishing these books still?
Adam Waffen.
Adam Waffen,
Adam
yeah.
Waffen's publishing them.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, that does make sense.
I hate it.
So, yeah, the Bowl Patrol and Adam Waffen both bring up Siege a lot. There's also a YouTube channel I found called Read Siege. They put up dozens of videos that have racked up more than 35,000 views, which is not a lot for a YouTube channel, but is a lot for homicidal Nazi propaganda.
Yeah, to think about 35,000 people that...
Well, probably just a couple thousand.
Like...
Just a couple thousand mass
couple
shooters,
thousand.
Katie.
Just a couple.
How
just
many...
A...
That's not that many mass shooters.
Just a couple thousand fans of a mass shooter. It's also
and,
like...
the, and a mass shooter book.
And mass shooter book. Mm-hmm. The Bowl Patrol is specifically Dylan Roof. There's also, who's that incel from like 3 or 4 years ago?
Elliot Rogers?
Elliot Rogers.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Saint Roger, they also
do the same thing.
He's got the same
like, kind of fan base.
And they're all kind of gradually morphing, like congealing together
into the
same broader ecosystem of people who are probably going to shoot up a bunch of innocent people.
Right, here's my resentment, here's your resentment. What if we are all resentful together?
And what if we all convince each other that the Jews are a part of it,
mm-hmm.
which is increasingly a fact.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, weird how it always gets back to Nazis. Like,
it is weird.
You scratch any of these groups of like psychotic kids who want to murder a bunch of strangers and you always keep finding Nazis.
Yeah, they fear the same thing and they want the same thing.
Yep.
Mm.
Weird. Although all of this news makes it way easier for me to understand stuff like, you read about the Holocaust. It's like, how'd you find all those people willing to work at those camps?
Oh, there's
a shitload of them.
Yeah,
Okay. Gotcha.
And they're easily sort of moved across
You can do a lot of stuff with them.
There's a lot of maneuvering that can be done with those kinds of people.
Yeah. Cool.
Cool.
Cool. So... the Read Siege YouTube channel has titles in it like The Lost White Civilization of China and a 37-minute... We're going past it, Cody. And a 37-minute video titled, Who Were the Jews?
Oh.
Oh.
I bet it's informative.
I bet it's informative.
I bet you find out.
You find out a lot. Many of their videos are just readings from pages of Siege. I would like to play a chunk from one of those videos titled, What Can We Dispense With?
President to dog catcher, they are all the same bureaucratic sellout swine. No distinctions are to be drawn. Meaningless considerations of parties, of left and right, and even individual identities, names, etc., are simply not to be used. To kill an ism, you have to kill the ists.
See.
So to kill anti-Semitism, I have to kill anti
Semites. Maybe that's right. No. Yeah. I bring this up because it highlights an important difference between the mentalities nurtured by Siege and the Turner Diaries. Adam Waffen, the most directly Siege-inspired extremist group, is nihilistic, often suicidally, though. Mm. Their name is the German word for atomic weapons because their whole deal is trying to bring about and eagerly awaiting the destruction of all society.
Mm-hmm.
And they have these weird ties now between like all these left and right wing like eco-terrorist groups mm-hmm. and like eco-fascist groups and like these leftist groups that started off as like anarchists, like individuals tending towards the wild, are starting to share more neo-Nazi propaganda. It's weird.
Because they all kind of, not the exact same goal, but they're kind of
they
related.
All want to fucking kill everything.
Yeah.
And that's what Siege is the book for. Turner Diaries is the book for people who are not nihilists. They want to build something. They want to build something by destroying something.
Right.
They want to build something. Siege is the book of, like, fuck it.
Yeah.
And I think that the reason the Turner Diaries killed more people up until now is that now is the time of fuck it.
Right, right. All these stories you were telling were like, oh yeah, 90s, like there's a different, kind of attitude about it. Now
we were all even the Nazi terrorists were more optimistic in the 90s.
Like, no. We can build something together.
Build something together.
Yeah, now it's burn it all down.
No, it's burn it all down.
Interesting.
The Turner Diaries was able to radicalize a guy like Timothy McVeigh because at its core, the book is not nihilistic. The diaries are good at inspiring wannabe revolutionaries to carry out violent actions. Siege is more suited to the kind of suicidal extremists that groups like ISIS also seek to radicalize. And by the way, Adam Offen loves them some ISIS, too. Mm-hmm. Share a lot of ISIS videos.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, it's basically tailor-made propaganda for the kind of 20-something young men who become mass shooters. I will talk much more about Siege in the book I'm shamelessly plugging.
It's not shameless. This is your podcast.
This is my podcast.
It's completely related to this exact topic.
But let's get back to Rockwell. Rockwell, George Lincoln, did not come up with the ideas of leaderless resistance or lone wolf terrorism himself.
Good for him.
He did not write the Turner Diaries or Siege, but he directly inspired and radicalized the men who did. If you scratch any ideological precept of modern fascism, you eventually wind up back at George Lincoln Rockwell. For example, you all know about 1488?
Of course I do.
And the significance of those numbers to Nazis?
Yeah.
It's basically, for the listeners who may not know, it's a covert way for Nazis to signal their Nazism without directly putting a swastika on their clothing or body. The 88 stands for Heil Hitler because H is the eighth letter of the alphabet, and the 14 words are as follows. We must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. That phrase was first written by David Lane, a member of Robert Matthews' criminal gang, The Order. Mm. While he was in prison, Lane also wrote a 3-page tract called White Genocide Manifesto. According to The Atlantic, it argued, quote, racial integration is only an euphemism for genocide and that the white race is on the verge of extinction due to interbreeding with other races.
Fucking stupid idiots.
I told
you
why genocide was going to come into it.
Moronic losers and their stupid dog shit ideas about everything. Oh my God.
Mm-hmm.
It's a conspiracy to get rid of. It's not like the natural thing that humans do.
It's all fear based. It's saying like I don't want to be treated like I treat people.
It's the same thing.
I feel like I'm going to get overrun and I'm not going to have my power and I'm afraid. I'm afraid.
The next time you hear white genocide out of the mouth of somebody trying to claim that they're like a relatively reasonable person, remind them the phrase was invented by a bank robber who got in prison for bank robbery because he joined a group that was inspired by a bad science fiction
I will
novel.
Say that if someone's talking about white genocide positively, they probably don't care.
Bank robbing Nazis. Mm-hmm. Congratulations on your great idea, buddy.
You stupid.
It's the same thing. There's like a Holocaust historian who was talking about this and like the like fascists of today and how like it's just like when they talk about globalism, it's like a conspiracy to like control everybody as opposed to like, well, no, like we're all connected more.
Yeah.
And like you have the internet and you have all these sort of ways that we can communicate.
Where do you think your coffee comes from, bro?
It's the natural progression of like a species on a planet.
Yeah.
I look so forward to less white faces as people like we're gonna be so much more attractive.
But like just like the,
and have better immune systems.
And have better
the
immune
basics
systems.
Of diversity and evolution. It's these people.
So if you've ever heard the phrase white genocide or seen a 1488 tattoo, you can thank at least half of that for David Lane. And Lane, of course, was directly inspired by William Luther Pierce, who was radicalized and molded by George Lincoln Rockwell.
There he is again.
He always comes back to Rockwell.
It's like a John Jacob Jingleheimer Schmidt for Nazis.
But with Nazis.
Yeah.
You know what's not for Nazis? The wonderful products and services that support this show and her program. Sophie's checking her phone out, so I think I can get away with that one. Nice. And products! The evidence keeps pouring in. At this point, the facts are undeniable. It's an open and shut case. Monopoly Go is the most fun you can have in a mobile game. Millions of people pass Go every day because this game is always bringing something new to the table.
Countless crazy tournaments you can join with your friends as partners or teams. Constantly changing challenges like money sprees or treasure hunts that keep it fresh with new wild minigames. Timed events offering bonuses like massive multipliers or rent frenzies to help you get huge rewards. And there's so many rewards to discover. Rare stickers you can trade with friends to complete albums, delightful emojis to taunt people with when you raid their riches, unique playing pieces, and so much more. The verdict is in with Monopoly Go. There's something new to discover every time you play. So don't miss out. Go download it now for free on the App Store and Google Play.
Bean Dad, the dress. 30 to 50 feral hogs. If you knew what any of those were, you spend too much time online. And hey, I do too. 16th Minute of Fame is a new weekly podcast hosted by me, Jamie Loftus, where every week I take a closer look at an internet character of the day. Who were they? What made them so notorious? Why did the internet choose them? And what does a person do when they're suddenly confronted with more attention than the human psyche can handle? I'll be talking to internet historians, experts, and yes, the main characters themselves to get a fuller picture. Because I think that even outside individual experiences, a character of the day tells us something about how the internet worked at that time and how the attention economy developed into the freaky three-headed dragon it is today. Together, we probably won't be able to properly log out, but we can take a walk down scary internet memory lane and see one day a little more clearly. Listen to 16th Minute of Fame on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh, my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And, of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back!
Yay!
You guys happy to be here? Y'all heard of Matthew Heimbach?
No.
He's the founder of the now-defunct Traditionalist Worker Party and one of the forces behind the first Deadly Unite the Right rally. He was a lot more prominent in the alt-right until after the Unite the Right rally in, like, in 2018, he got caught sleeping with the wife of his spokesman, a guy named Matthew Parrott.
Yeah.
Oh man, and the nickname some people came up with for that whole event, which led to the destruction of the TWP. It's beautiful. The Night of Wrong Wives.
Oh, that's so good.
That's all it took to break them apart.
Wow. Oh,
that's so good.
Clever can you get.
Really smart. Really, really good
that
joke.
Yeah.
I don't know who made it. Might have been a Nazi.
Might
still
a
good
Nazi,
joke. Still a really good joke.
Oh,
Now, Matthew Heimbach was for a while the most or one of the most notorious white supremacists in the country. He gained notoriety early on in the mid-aughts as the young, media-savvy face of white nationalism. One of his innovations in terms of presenting fascism to Americans was to focus on racial separatism instead of white supremacy. Heimbach went out of his way to say that whites are not inherently superior. Richard Spencer preached a broadly similar gospel, at least to reporters. Rockwell was more openly racist and fascist than either of those men, but he pioneered the use of the tactic they both used. We can see the seeds of this strategy in his support for the Nation of Islam and black nationalism. Rockwell told a reporter at the time that his only disagreement with the Nation of Islam was, quote, they want a chunk of America, and I prefer that they go to Africa. Heimbach basically refined that to, I think they should stay in predominantly black areas like Detroit, and rural America should stay white. In a very real way, Rockwell represents a bridge between the original Nazis, Hitler and crew, and modern neo-Nazis and fascists in America. I spent quite a lot of time reading through Unicorn Riot's archives of fascist Discord conversations, mostly from members of the groups that planned the first deadly Unite the Right rally. These people talk about Rockwell, or GLR, pretty regularly. Here's one quote. Today is the birthday of Commander George Lincoln Rockwell. Honor this man by cooking a steak, celebrating National Socialism, pride in being white, and calling your neighbor an N-word. Here I have linked a playlist to a series of videos about George Lincoln Rockwell that you can play throughout the day. Personally, I'm having a cookout with some edgy friends, and I'm going to be blasting this shit.
That is so funny.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Cody, I mean, Cody's funny.
Cody,
really
Cody
funny.
Might die.
What do you mean, my edgy friends? Oh my god, these losers. All right, sorry.
We're gonna have a barbecue and play the words of a Nazi who's been dead for 60 years. Edgy.
Me and my edgy friends. All right. I think
he has a different definition of edgy than I do.
Yeah, I think he's a loser.
Have fun and always remember, and he quotes from Rockwell here, life is a struggle, even to stand up is a struggle against the law of gravity. And I think that the joy of life is in the struggle itself, not the victory. Because if it were, we'd all lose. We're all going to croak. We all lose the battle of life. So if you can't find some fun in the fight to live and live to the fullest, then you're a failure already before you even start. Hey. Live life for the fullest.
Yeah.
Heil Hitler.
And have some fun while you're at it, y'all.
Have some fun while you are making racist banners to troll Martin Luther King Jr. with.
With your edgy friends.
With your
edgy friends. If you're not having fun, what's the point?
With your edgy friends like the guy in the gorilla costume. And the dude who shoots you in a couple of years.
Sure, sure. Yeah, real edgy. Like a bunch of edgelords just killing each other. And oh god, and you had to explicitly say it, like me and my, we're like
edgy,
we're edgy. Oh, I love it. I also love that like there's the whole like I just think that they should stay where they are. And we should stay. We're not superior. That's literally a Hitler quote of him saying like, no, I don't think we're superior. I think like Chinese people stay in China. Mm-hmm. You stay where you. Japanese people stay in Japan. Yeah, that's all I think.
Hey, the Axis was a multiracial empire.
You see?
Mm-hmm. It included all the races. Right. Germans, Italians, Japanese people. Yeah. That's the whole spectrum.
My edgy Japanese friends. There was also edgy that Italian friends.
One group of Indian soldiers. Yep.
There you go.
Yeah. The Indish Legion. They hated Britain.
Hitler wasn't racist, confirmed.
Yeah, that is actually how that's been turned into.
Oh, I bet.
Yeah.
Oh, I also hate the internet. Don't worry. I'm there too.
Countercurrents.com, a Nazi website for fucking Nazis, commissioned an article on Rockwell in honor of his birthday, written by Gregory Hood, author of a book called Rockwell Was Right. So Gregory Hood's analysis is interesting to me. Quote, Rockwell's National Socialism was not an ideology so much as a tactic, an attempt to build a fighting conservatism capable of defeating the militant left. Rather than Nietzsche, Baron Evola, or even Alfred Rosenberg, the greatest influences on George Lincoln Rockwell were Senator Joe McCarthy, Douglas MacArthur, and even William F. Buckley. His inability to rally the American right marks a milestone in white political activism, as George Lincoln Rockwell is the bridge between patriotic racial conservatism and revolutionary white nationalism. Not wrong.
Not wrong. Not relevant. Didn't make me think of a lot of stuff today.
Constantly.
Just a random quote from a random person.
Random quote from a random Nazi website. This is why a guy like Rockwell can influence both explicit neo-Nazi terrorists and much more moderate, less murderous groups like the Proud Boys. If you spend any time hanging out with the Proud Boys or watching Patriot Prayer rallies or watching videos posted by either of these groups, members of them will regularly and proudly describe themselves as
anti-communist. Mm-hmm. If you go to any of these bloody rallies, as I have, you will see anti-communist action shirts, and you will hear the phrase anti-communist or anti-com bandied about constantly. In June of 1960, George Lincoln Rockwell went to court to defend his application to march at Union Square in New York City. There were huge protests of his presence, some of which disrupted the court proceedings. A recess was called, and Rockwell took the opportunity to go out and speak to some of the waiting TV cameras. According to the book For Race and Nation, quote, Rockwell told television reporters that the ANP was growing every minute, but that his goals had been misrepresented by newspapers. Contrary to newspaper reports, we are not trying to exterminate anybody, but we are trying to eliminate communism. We want to shock the American people into the awareness of the extreme danger of what is going on. After that, he said he only wanted to gas traitors, which he expected would encompass no more than 80% of the Jewish population.
Sorry.
I don't want to exterminate anybody. 80% of the Jews, maybe.
Just the traitors. About 80% of the population.
Yeah, communism is the same thing as Judaism is the same thing. Yeah, cultural Marxism is the same thing as any art, leftism, liberalism, it's
cultural
all the
Bolshevism.
Same.
I mean, it's latching on to something that's a sticking point with people that they're afraid of, and they don't understand, and then like milking that.
Unite the right to defeat
the
authoritarian left.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Now, when Rockwell said this little line about gassing 80% of Jewish people in America, this caused many in the crowd to shout at him. One person tried to attack him, but was held back. The reporter asked Rockwell how he responded to such rage. Rockwell replied, quote, I'm used to it. They never make such a fuss over communist speaking. It's only when someone is an anti-communist.
No. There's more to it.
Is that why?
In life, George Lincoln Rockwell was never able to unite the right. But in death, his ideas have gone on to have influence at every level of the radical right-wing ecosystem. I would like to close by quoting a paper from the University of Glasgow, The Leaderless Resistance, George Lincoln Rockwell, and the White Separatist Movement. Quote, the advantage of history and political context allows an accurate appraisal of Rockwell and American Nazism. Rockwell, as a phenomenon, has never been equaled in the American far right. With his panache, charisma, ability to manipulate situations, and gain media exposure, Rockwell had little in common with many of his followers who were attracted to the Nazi philosophy he advocated. Prior to Rockwell, the extreme right was an exclusive resort, devoid of Catholics and non-Aryan whites. It was Rockwell who ended that exclusivity. I care not what religion, club, area, or class you come from, nor what bit of colored cloth you wave as a flag. We are all under deadly attack. GLR!
GLR.
GLR. Is that a cheer for that guy? That's, I mean, every single time we're on this show.
Yeah, it's hard to come up with new ways to say, yep.
And they acknowledge, like a lot of these groups acknowledge him and are aware.
He's very regularly talked at. He shows up all the time. If you go to Unicorn Riot's database of Discord leaks of all these different groups from Identity Europa, the TWP, he comes up constantly.
Sure.
They love him.
Yeah.
I love him. Can't get enough.
And he's you know, there's a great book called Everything You Love Will Burn, which is about, it was about a guy who's like, for like 2011 on to 2016, he was just hanging out with these guys, like Matthew Heimbach and different fascist right-wing guys, and like decided during the 2016 election, oh, I got to write a book about this. Like I'm gonna do this thing. And Rockwell comes up in that. Like he's a lot of other people have made this connection. He is the, I mean, and you know, even when it's indirect, like with Siege and the Turner Diaries, right. He's still the guy who was talking to the fucking author of Siege when that dude was fucking 14 years old.
Right.
He's the guy who gave William Pierce his first newsletter and, you know, started him on the path to writing the Turner Diaries. He is patient zero of the fucking plague that killed 11 people in the Tree of Life Synagogue, that led Christopher Hassan to plan a massacre, and that's going to be behind the massacre that may have happened by the time this episode drops. Mm-hmm. So, GLR.
Go.
Disturbing.
Lose. Fucker.
Well, fucker. That
I know. I was going for it looks like an R.
We've been at this for a while. Curve.
Go lose.
Get lost.
Get lost.
Something.
One pump.
Get lost Rockwell. I don't know.
Get lost Rockwell. There you go. That was good.
Thank you.
I liked his reaction. Robert's reaction was much better than yours.
I'm still upset at my failure.
I know. Wow. I mean, my brain feels a little mushy from all of that.
Yeah, it
but
hurts.
But also horrified.
Mushified.
Mushified.
I choose to not learn anything from this, though.
Yeah, no, this is the right decision.
All this history and sort of seems relevant, but I'm going to push it out of my mind. I'm not going to.
Ignore it.
I'm just going to ignore it.
It'll probably be fine.
I think it'll be fine.
Probably be fine.
History's for losers.
Trying to find a quote.
My favorite quote about history is, those who learn from history shouldn't say anything because it's not important.
This is what Lindsay from You're the Worst says about history.
Okay.
Whatever history, you happened already. Let it go. That's funny.
Oh, 21st century right there.
Yep. If you care about history and are worried about all this stuff, I have an audiobook.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot more that I had to leave out because I wrote 13,000 words about George Lincoln Rockwell. There's a whole lot more. Christian identity, talking more about Siege and the Turner Diaries, and a bunch of other stuff that we did not get to that explains Dylann Roof and all these other fucking mass murderers. The audiobook that I'm working on is called The War on Everyone. You can go to GoFundMe, look up The War on Everyone, donate. I'll make that audiobook, and then I'll use the money to go stare at these people at rallies and ask them difficult questions.
Leading up to the 2020.
And then I'll do stuff.
Disaster,
into,
woo! The worst year of everybody's life.
I really feel like the Democrats are going to get it together.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Interesting theory.
That seems historically like what they'll do.
Yeah, yeah. I have a lot of faith in that.
Everyone will get behind one candidate. Mm-hmm. They'll do a great job of campaigning. Mm-hmm. The news media won't breathlessly cover the lies that the president says about that candidate.
Okay.
There will be no more fighting in the streets. Then we will elect an actual being of light who descends from the sky and is just the reincarnated soul of Mr. Rogers, who will lead us into a future of national health care and moderate environmental activism so that we can stop the nightmare. Yeah.
Interesting.
I have to say,
bisexual
when
icon,
you
Mr.
said
Rogers.
Confidently that you think the Democrats will get it together, my heart lifted a little bit, and then you kept talking.
I mean, they might.
No, I think what you're saying
might.
Is...
I mean, I'll say this. In 2008, when, like, before Barack Obama was, like, the candidate, I was looking at him and Hillary duking it out, and I was like, oh, the Democrats are going to fuck it up, and after 8 years of George W. Bush, we're gonna get fucking... This mess.
Yeah.
And then the best political candidate of my lifetime, or best at least political campaign of my lifetime happened. Maybe.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we don't know. Everything starts so soon now.
Yeah.
Like it's March, the year before the actual election.
It's March, and by my count, 146 million people are running for president.
Sherrod Brown just said he's not running anymore.
Oh,
so,
okay.
Bye.
Oh, good.
That's good.
I support. Less
I
people running
yeah,
for president.
I do like him. I mean, I don't like his
you
policies.
You just like his voice.
I like his voice. He seems like an affable man that I'd enjoy dinner with. I wasn't going to vote for him.
Yeah.
Anywho.
We need more coffee billionaires.
Yeah.
I think that'll help.
Oh, man, that coffee billionaire. Because if there's one thing, I don't have a joke. One pump.
It'll be fine. It'll be good. One cream for one pump.
I think we've come up with the slogan that's going to win in
2020. No matter who the candidate is.
Yes.
Well, just
I believe in one pump, one cream.
I'm imagining, Cody, picture this in your mind's eye, 500,000 people crowding the streets of Washington, D.C., flooding the National Wall, their hands on placards, shouting at the White House in one voice as one people, one pump, one cream.
Oh, yeah, it's one pump, one cream, not one cream, one pump.
Yeah, I see that. I see that very vividly.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
I see the, like a phoenix, America rising
from the ashes.
Above the powdered cream
the powdered
ashes.
Cream.
Sure.
The Ted Cruz cum.
Oh, how did we get here?
It's 3 hours of this.
Yeah. You guys want to plug your pluggables before we start saying something crazy?
More than anything in the world.
Yeah, you know, internet.
Yeah,
people.
We do a weekly YouTube
podcast. Weekly podcast
called Even More News. We do a weekly YouTube show called Some More News. Google that. You can support it via patreon.com/somemorenews.
That was a good job.
Yeah. We did
We should just like designate one of us to do this each episode.
Each episode.
I like chaos. Hierarchy is a cancer. Do it this way.
Some More News. Patreon.com. Hit me on the internet. Katie Stoll. At katiestoll.com.
Beautiful.
No. I'm Dr. Mr. Cody on Twitter also.
I'm Robert Evans. I'm Robert at OK on Twitter. You can find this podcast at BehindTheBastards.com. You can find t-shirts if you want a t-shirt. I'm sure we'll have a one cream shirt.
Oh, yeah.
Can we get it in a tank?
We can get it in a tank
a
top.
Wallet. You
a
know,
wallet. Gotta, stickers.
Yeah.
Put them on everything. One.
I want like a Rosie the Riveter on there. Not her exactly, but.
You can find all the sources for this on our website, BehindTheBastards.com. I'm Robert Evans. Until next time, for the love of God, if you remember nothing else, remember, one pump, one cream.
Bean Dad, The Dress, 30 to 50 feral hogs. If you knew what any of those were, you spend too much time online. And hey, I do too. 16th Minute of Fame is a new weekly podcast hosted by me, Jamie Loftus. And every week, we take a closer look at an internet character of the day. Who are they? What made them so notorious? How did the internet or the algorithm choose them? And what does a person do when they're suddenly confronted with more attention than the human psyche can handle? Listen to 16th Minute of Fame on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.